Alright everyone, welcome back to another edition of Ringside Chat Podcast. We are missing probably one third of our co-hosting team with Gary being out. So tonight is myself, Joe Kasvinsky, and Court Montgomery. Court, what's going on?
Oh, not a whole lot, man. No computer issues, hopefully, this time. So off to a better start.
Yeah, we were having a little bit of recording issues. We didn't have all our ducks in a row, but we think we got straightened out now for the second episode.
Let's hope so. This just proves that we need Gary a little more than I realize. So. Maybe I should have admitted that. He'll hold that shit over my head now.
Oh, trust me, he will. Well, after we had our first show up on Thursday, we posted it on numerous Facebook groups and advertised it on Twitter. And so far, the reviews that I've gotten so far seem pretty positive. Numbers look pretty good for our first episode, given that we really don't have like a big machine pushing this thing right now. So, what have you gotten from feedback about it?
I know we kind of talked about it before on the general feedback I've gotten has been very similar to yours, that it just seems like it's just a natural, we're just a group of friends talking about wrestling, which I'm glad it came off that way. A lot of people were happy with the first episode. The length of it was good too, because, you know, not everybody wants to listen to a bunch of assholes talk for an hour, so I was happy with that. Nothing bad, you know, honestly, and we have people already asking when the next one's coming out, so it's nice to have, you know, people interested in what we're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the same stuff that I've gotten, that, you know, obviously you and I and Gary, we've all been talking for a while now, so that's what they've liked about it. Yeah, and I agree. The length is pretty good. I like shows like the 605 Super Podcast and the Pritchard Show and Shabani Show, but I mean it is a long listen for 3 hours, sometimes even four.
So, definitely.
So yeah, I'm definitely glad about that. This episode we were gonna do something special, but Gary's got food poisoning. We think it was his wife. So
pretty sure his wife poisoned him.
Well, I mean, it's not like he probably hasn't done things that deserve it.
Hell yeah, I'm pretty sure I'm right there with you.
Yeah. So tonight what we're going to do is we're going to table what we were going to do for this show. We're going to move it, so that'll be maybe episode 3 or maybe episode 2.0 or something like that. So for this episode, we're just pretty much going to do a little bit just basically what last episode was kind of like. So one of the things I wanted to talk about was today marks another birthday for Owen Hart, who passed away way too young. He would have been 52 today. So rather than really talk about all the negative stuff around that, let's just talk about the positive stuff. So, Court, when was the first time you seen Owen Hart, and what are some memories you got about him?
Well, if you remember from the first episode, you know, I told you one of my prouder moments of going to shows was being able to see Owen Hart live. Owen Hart is a huge inspiration for me as a professional wrestler, and also just, I love him. You know, as a kid, for the most part, we all like the good guys. You know, these are the people you look up to. You want to boo the bad guys. For some reason, and to this day I still can't explain it other than he was just that damn good. I loved Owen Hart as a kid. Like, cause the time I really remember Owen was, right around the time, right before his heel turn. I know I'd seen him around, like, you teaming with Coco and stuff like that. And, you know, of course I've gone back and watched all that stuff cause, you know, late 80s, early 90s, WWF is my bread and butter. But I really remember Owen Hart right around the lead up to, you know, Royal Rumble 1994, when he finally turned on Bret and, you know, and all that. Just I can't express how much I love Owen Hart more than I already have. So.
Yeah.
But what about you?
Well, like I said, I got into wrestling around 95, And so at that point, I kind of knew that Ed Owen and Brett were brothers, but I didn't, at that time, I didn't know because, like I said, I hadn't watched hardly anything previously. But the first, really outside of, I think, a Monday Night Raw, the first big thing that I watched was Royal Rumble 95. 95 or 96. Well, it was whatever one, I think it was the second one that Shawn won to go on to WrestleMania 12. But what stood out to me the most was Owen Hart had done that enziguri kick that I had never seen before to that point and kicked the back of the head of Shawn Michaels. And then they did that whole angle where, well, we don't know if he's going to wrestle again, and they played up that whole thing basically that was resulting from the beating he took in Syracuse. And I just remember thinking, like how cool Owen Hart was, because, like, I sort of figured that pro wrestling was, you know, there was some little bit of work to it, but I figured, like, man, Owen Hart's real. He freaking almost killed Shawn Michaels or ended his career. And, like, it stuck out to me so big. And then when they won the two Slammies, and he treated those things had a bigger value than the WWF title at the time. So,
oh yeah,
things like that really, really stick out to me. Now, I didn't really care for Owen too much when he was in the Nation, but I was a big Owen fan when he was with the Hart Foundation in 97, and things like that, and until I was able to go back and watch all his older matches and stuff. And he was just like, I mean, I love Bret Hart. I'm one of his biggest fans. But, man, Owen's like right up there for me. He was just the best.
Oh, yeah. And I know this is kind of a, not a lot of people agree with this. I mean, I've always loved Bret too. But in my opinion, honestly, I think Owen was better than Bret. Just with Owen being a little younger, and his style at the time wasn't really widely accepted, because he did a little more acrobatic type stuff than anyone else did. I mean, you know, I went back. I don't know if you've seen the Owen Hart DVD Blu-ray set that was released for WWE, I think, last year.
No, I haven't checked that out yet.
Man, please go and buy it. It's worth every penny. Like, I remember I found it at Best Buy the week it came out. And it's awesome. And I went back and, you know, they have a couple of Stampede matches. And, dude, he was like, he would grab someone by the hand, like the wrist, and kind of like a Lucha-style move where he would grab them. He would run up the ropes, kind of like almost like Undertaker, like walking the top rope. He would take two steps, drop on his ass, and backflip out of the move and arm drag a guy. And, dude, we're talking like, this is like, I want to say it was either like 87, 88. No one was doing stuff like that, period. And he was just so innovative, especially early on. Now, you know, of course, like, I talked about this last time. You get in the WWF, you know, you're wrestling 6 days a week or 7 days a week back then. You know, you're not going to do as much as when you first started out. But even then, Owen found ways to do things that were completely different. Like, I went back. I love, one of my favorite things from WWF is Primetime Wrestling. One of my favorite shows. And there's a lot of really random good stuff when he was Blue Blazer. He would, you know, the job guys didn't care. They were there to make money or whatever. And Owen was hitting them with all kinds of cool stuff off the top rope that no one else was doing. So I'm thinking, at least early on, that's why Owen didn't get as much attention. Because, yes, it's flashy, but he was there during a time when wrestling was completely different. You know, Owen was probably at least a good 5 years ahead of his time. Had he come around later on, I have no doubt that he would have been world champion.
Oh, absolutely. He to me, he's like, I would put him in like Sean Waltman in the same grouping that, you know, they got, it's kind of tough that they got put, you know, they're around at that time, but had they grown up, say, like now, that definitely they would be probably world champions in the WWE or Ring of Honor or elsewhere. And that was one of the things that I've noticed, like, going on back on the network, that, and then also reading Brett's book, that when you see some of the house shows that Owen was squaring off against Brett, he was doing some things that I think blew away what he the match they had at WrestleMania 10. And it was almost, you know, while he was doing heel stuff, but, you know, like you were saying with his some of his moveset, he was the stuff he was doing was babyface stuff. That I think that had, you know, like I said, he'd come around, you know, 5 or 10 years later, you know, he would have been probably the biggest baby face in the company right now.
Yeah, the only unfortunate thing, and I don't know how much this is true, and I don't know if you've ever heard this rumor. Okay, so you know, at SummerSlam, was it 90, when did he break Austin's neck? Was it 96, 97?
I think it was 96.
Okay. So, you know, he did the reverse tombstone and he broke Austin's neck. The rumor to it is, and apparently Brett confirmed there's some truth to it, is that, you know, Owen never called Austin to, like, say, like, hey, man, you okay? You know, whatever. And Austin took that to heart and took it very personally. I bring that up, and then Brett, I think, said that the reason Owen didn't do it was he felt so bad he didn't want to bother Steve. Steve's kept that. So when it came time, when Austin was the top guy, and Austin had all these people to work with, that's the reason we never saw the Owen versus Austin rematches, is that Austin could put the kibosh on it, and he was like, no, I don't want to work with Owen, how about somebody else? Because he had so much resentment from when he broke his neck.
Right.
And let's, you know, I just think about, had that not happened, you know, if this is true, like I said, it's all hearsay, but let's say that is the case. Can you imagine if they were still on good terms, the matches they could have had later on for the title? I mean, they would have been a completely different style because Owen was starting to kind of tone down some stuff. He was still very technical, but he's getting a little more rugged when he was, you know, when he was with the Nation and stuff like that. Just the matches that they could have had on a main event level, it just it upsets me thinking that we never got a chance to enjoy that. You know?
Oh, absolutely. And I think too, one of the things that's really not, I don't think that people look at when they talk about Owen Hart is, I think his promos were probably just as good, if not better, than Brett's. The promos with him and Austin probably would have been top-notch, especially given that Owen was walking around with I broke your neck, you know, t-shirt and stuff like that. That would have probably been, you know, I probably could have been WrestleMania 13 Brett Austin level. If they were able to have that chance to do that.
Oh, for sure, man. I just think about what happened, you know, unfortunately, you know, at Over the Edge. Man, I feel like Owen, like, even like say things didn't work out with WWF, you know, the things that Owen could have done with the talent that emerged not long after his unfortunate passing, man, there is so much, like, because, I mean, he had stuff with, like, guys like Edge and Christian when they were really, you know, didn't have a lot of experience. Can you imagine, like, later on when they were really coming into their own, you know, like, doing stuff with, like, the Hardys maybe later on? I mean, like, this guy is just completely the limit for stuff Owen could have done. And while I'm thinking about one of the funnier Owen moments I remember, and, I mean, this is something involved Owen. I don't know if it was his spot or not, but it just say it from all the stories of his ribs and stuff, it sounds like something he would do. To this day, I still can't find it, but I remember it vividly when I was a kid. Going back to, you know, you brought up one of your earlier memories was the Shawn angle with the Enziguri. This was either right before that or right after that. You know, he was, Owen was in Camp Cornette. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they weren't called Camp Cornette yet, but I remember specifically because it was Owen and he had Fuji and Cornette in his corner. And this was like, you know, Superstars or Livewire or, you know, one of the old WWF shows. He's wrestling Shawn in a singles match in a main event. Owen tries to hit him with something. Shawn, like, hip toss him or something to get him down. Well, Cornette gets on the ring, and Shawn flips Cornette in, hits him, and pins him, and the referee counts to three. Then Fuji comes in, gets knocked down. Shawn pins him, gets the three. Then Owen comes down, boom, pins him, 1, 2, 3, Shawn wins the match. And it's like, you see, like, seeing that as a kid, I'm thinking, oh, man, Shawn got the best of him, whatever. And then I see it as an adult. I'm like, all of these guys were having so much fun in that moment. Yeah. And it's one of the things where you don't, unfortunately, wrestling, and actually lately, wrestling's kind of changed. You hear more of that. But, like, back then, And that's why you've literally never heard anyone say a bad word about Owen. And whatever the Austin situation was, to this day, he still doesn't say a bad word about it.
No.
You know, so and you people aren't like that. You know, I've heard all kinds of stories about how selfless he was, that he would give anybody anything as far as, you know, he would give you the shirt off his back, or in a wrestling match, he would rather you get all your stuff in. He would look like an idiot, character-wise, just to make sure that the other person he was wrestling looked like a superstar. And it's just that's what made him great.
Yeah, that's what I think one of the things that as a kid, if I would know then what I know now, would surprise me at the time, because I mean I still kept, you know, K-Babe was still real to me. So seeing guys like him being a heel and then finding out later that no, he's a pretty decent guy, that would have just blew my mind. And I think it also surprised me when I would see in the magazines when they would go to charities and stuff, and you'd see him there and a bunch of other wrestlers thinking, like, man, he's supposed to be a heel. He's supposed to hate the fans and stuff. But no, he goes out there and does that stuff. And it just, it just blows my mind that's the type of person he is. It is a shame. You know, you were talking about the different matchups, you know, down the road. One of the things that I would have loved to have seen was if when they brought in guys like Jericho, when they brought in guys like Benoit and Guerrero and Malenko, I'd love to see them work with Owen. I think those
God yes
matchups would have been excellent,
because all those guys were brought in. Like at least I know Jericho was brought in before the Radicals were, but I mean it was what months later. Like it was not that long later before Jericho came in and stuff, and just all the missed opportunities. But, you know, Owen, like, he was pretty decorated, too, for that time. Like, even though he didn't win the world title in WWF, you know, he had the Intercontinental title. He had the tag team titles with multiple partners. Trying to remember, obviously, I know he had it with Bulldog, and he had it with Yoko.
Right.
Because he's a four-time tag champion. Did he have any other? Oh, Jeff Jarrett.
Jeff Jarrett, was one.
And he could have been multiple time partners, like win the belts twice with maybe Bulldog or Yoko or something. But you know, other than maybe trying to think, this would be a good trivia question for later on down the road, or if anybody's listening can give the answer to us. So Owens won the belt with at least three different partners that we can remember. I can think of maybe Billy Gunn and maybe Edge, as far as guys that may have equal or more tag partners. I can't think of anybody else that has that many different partners, you know. But that's good for Owen because he blended it with everybody.
Yeah, I mean, well, if you look at it, I got his information pulled up. Okay, now so in Stampede, he was a mid heavyweight champion one time.
And yeah, I knew he had a lot in Stampede.
And then he was a tag team champion once, and then a North American champion twice. Then he did the USWA. He was the Unified World Heavyweight Champion once.
Okay.
And then in the WWE, he was a European Champion once, two-time Intercontinental, the King of the Ring, and then he was a four-time with twice with Yoko, once with Bulldog,
okay,
once with Jeff.
And, nice.
I mean, that's pretty impressive, and that's not even counting, you know, him doing stuff with Neidhart, and not including stuff with Coco. And, I mean, to me, say what you will about him being linked tag team titles with those guys, I thought him with Coco, I thought they were pretty good.
Oh, God, yes. I loved it. I'm a huge, even though they lasted, I think, a couple of months, I could be exaggerating, but it seemed like it was a short amount of time. I was such a huge New Foundation fan when with him and Neidhart, mm-hmm, you know, just and him and Coco did great stuff, but like the only thing that was really weird to me as a kid is like he's with Jim Neidhart and he's doing this and all of a sudden he's teaming with Coco with the same clothes, the same. It was just like that was weird to me, you know. It's like, yeah, you know, but they work, they blend it very well, you know. They're high energy, right? That was a tag team name.
Yeah.
You know, they very well. I actually joke with my tag team partner all the time that we really should get high energy gear. You know, he's not totally sold on being Coco. But I just, whatever. I just, I love it.
What was it, the neon colors, the checker pattern, and then the hammer pants?
Man, I don't care. I do it. I mean, I think that was his biggest problem. He's like, I really don't want to wear the suspenders. I'm like, it makes the outfit. Maybe I could talk him into just getting, like high-energy inspired gear or something. One thing, while I'm thinking about it, is talking about him and Neidhart later on. Little fun fact. So, Yokozuna was his mystery partner at WrestleMania 11, and they beat the Smoking Guns for tag titles. That was actually supposed to be Neidhart. And he, I can't remember if he got fired. He left the company in January of that year. But Neidhart and him were supposed to win the tag belts. And I guess that's a testament to Owen, too, that the company is still like, well, we still want to put the belts on Owen. Who do we have? They're like, we can give him Yoko. Okay, sure, that works, you know. And that upsets me to an extent because, I always enjoyed Jim Neidhart. I mean, maybe he wasn't the best technical wrestler, but he was a big powerhouse. You know, he was a solid mass. He just beat the shit out of people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been a fan going back now and going back and watching stuff that I either wasn't born, you know, I was too young to see or whatever. I love, the Hart Foundation with Brett and Jim. I think Jim is a very good, basically a change of pace to the other guy, and I like a lot of stuff that Jim did, and it's just a shame that he just didn't have his head on straight most of the time, but.
It's always the other guy. It's like fucking Jim Neidhart, Marty Jannetty. Mm-hmm. It's like, what the fuck, guys? Well, the only opposite to that rule is like the Steiner brothers. Like,
right.
Rick Steiner, for the most part, was like always, well, later on, I've heard, it, back in the day, he was the crazy one. Mm-hmm. But Rick was like the most normal. And, but fucking crazy ass Scotty Steiner, he was the one who got the push and the fucking title and all that shit. But, God, I could be here for another whole episode talking about the Steiner brothers. Oh, while I'm thinking about it, you know, I mentioned it on the last episode, but I'm going to bring it back. Man, if you haven't seen the Steiner brothers versus the Hart brothers in that one-time match where, like, Scotty Steiner gives Owen the fucking screwdriver, like, 2 minutes in or whatever it was. I mean, the match is good, but it's like that's something else. It's like, I know that pretty much from the get-go, the whole reason they ever put Brett and Owen together was just to build up to the eventual turn in the feud. But, man, I wish that they should have given the Harts a title run, you know? That could have been Owen's big deal, and then let them lose the belts and do the turn. I mean, I'm not trying to be armchair booker, but I say that in a sense of, because I just wanted to see more of it, because Owen and Brett didn't team much. You know, and they had, obviously they're brothers, so they're going to have good chemistry. And they had greater chemistry as opponents. I just would have loved to seen that there's so many matchups, even in that time where, let's be fair, around like 94 to 96, WWF didn't have the best roster and weren't having the best matches. You never saw something bad from Brett and Owen. So them as the tag team division, I think could have been really special. You know, had they started it earlier or waited a little longer, you know, something.
Right. Yeah, I think the tag division at that time, going back and looking, like, it seemed pretty, I mean, I know the roster was pretty thin at that point anyways, but it seemed pretty thin because given that really all you had was you had the, you know, a couple times you had those guys wrestle, you had the Steiners, the Head Shrinkers, the Smoking Guns, I think, were still there. And I think you had Bob Holly and the 1-2-3 Kid. And I'm trying to think really what else was out there. I mean, there might be something out there that I'm just not thinking of right now. But, yeah, it would seem that would have... Not that, I mean, the feud was bad or anything, but I definitely think that would have probably been a little bit of a cooler touch to have those guys win the belts and then set up the feud down the road that way.
Yeah, and one thing that I don't know if you remember this or like, because I know this is right around the time you got into it or shortly after, but I know much like me, you've gone back and watched a lot of this stuff. I always thought that I mean, they had this long feud. I mean, it really started Survivor Series 93 when Owen threw the hissy fit because he was the only heart eliminated. That was where they planted the seed. They did not really stop feuding until they pretty much got back together in the new Heart Foundation years later. But I always thought it was very weird because, you know, the lead up was to SummerSlam 94 and they had that, God, I think it was like a 30-minute cage match, which was phenomenal. But, you know, they still feuded a little while after that and up until Survivor Series of that year. That's where Brett lost the belt to Bob Backlund because Owen comes down, convinces his mom, Helen, to throw in the towel. But and maybe they did it on house shows. I'm not quite – maybe my memory's just bad because I've taken a lot of chair shots and shit. Okay, Owen cost Brett the title.
Right.
I don't remember there being a payoff to that. Like, it was just that Brett kept feuding with Backlund through WrestleMania. It was weird. I felt like there was not a real closure. Every once in a while, they would peep back in and do a little bit together. But it was always odd to me. Like, I wonder why, if there was a reason why, or they just wanted to slowly, like, not have a complete blow-off. And just that way, you know, they always have Owen there as there's tension, but not to completely end the feud so they can go back to it. I always thought that was weird, because I don't remember anything to do with Owen and Brett after Survivor Series that year when he cost him the belt to Backlund.
Yeah, now that I'm thinking about that, yeah, that is real weird because and I do remember that ever after that feud that every once in a while, whether it be a Superstars or a Raw or something like that, like they might cross paths with each other or something like that. But yeah, for the most part, it seemed like, you know, they might bring it up a teeny bit, but for the most part, yeah, it seemed like it kept them away. And I think that you could have really built up to something big with playing up the whole he cost his brother the title angle.
Yeah, like, I mean, again, not trying to be armchair Booker, but it was so weird to me that they kept with, you know, Bob, you know, Backlund loses the belt the very next night at Madison Square Garden to Diesel, and it starts the whole big Diesel push. But then they, you know, they do that, but they keep with the Brett-Bob Backlund feud to go to WrestleMania 11. To me, it wasn't a lot of hatred. It was just crazy-ass Bob Backlund coming back and winning the title randomly. The feud was Owen and Brett. So if Owen cost him the title, why not use that and then push that again to another WrestleMania match? Where, I mean, even though, yes, obviously Brett's beaten Owen tons of times, but at WrestleMania, Owen had the victory. So there could have been a story there, have Brett beat Owen at WrestleMania 11. I mean, it's just me, maybe just because I want to see more Brett and Owen matches.
Yeah, that's why I do like going back, and they do have some on the network, and I think if you go on one of the DVDs, I think is very underrated that the WWE put out, and it was the Bret Hart Dungeon Collection, which has a lot of those, a lot of matches that really never been seen before. And I know there's a couple Owen versus Bret matches on there and stuff. That's why I go back and check them out, because I would have loved to have seen more. And I think there would have been more to it if they would have gone back to it. But yeah, I definitely agree. I really wish they would have done some more things down the road with them.
Oh, yeah, there are plenty of opportunities. But that, I don't know. I love Owen Hart, so I can sit here and bitch and moan all day. Like, why didn't they put him against this guy? That was great. Or why didn't we see more of this? I don't care. It's just more Owen Hart, I got better. And, it's always nice seeing stuff later that, like, I haven't seen. Like, recently, like, funny enough, today, I had no idea but until, like, what, 10 minutes before we started recording that you were like, hey, we're going to talk about Owen Hart. I honestly had no idea it was his birthday today. Mm-hmm. But I was looking up, like, just random stuff on YouTube, getting ready for the podcast. Like, what are we going to talk about tonight? Just because with Gary getting sick, it kind of threw us off a little bit. And I was looking up, because I wanted to, which this can segue into our next topic. I was looking up, I couldn't remember if the very first In Your House had a special themes or not.
Yes.
And so I was like, hey, I wonder if it, you know, whatever. So I go find it. And as I'm listening to it, I'm like, man, I love Owen Hart's theme song. I want to listen to that. I looked it up, which led me, and I don't know if you fall down the rabbit hole that is YouTube sometimes, I ended up finding, for my house show, a 60-minute Ironman match between Brett and Owen.
Oh, really?
Yes, man. And I didn't watch, I watched like the 10 minutes of the beginning, just because I didn't have an hour today to watch it. But I can only imagine it's just the greatest shit that wrestling has ever produced, because it's Brett and Owen fucking Hart, man. Like,
oh yeah, go an hour. I mean, that has to be really something.
Because the I'm sure it's a little bit of celebration, but the video is an hour and 8 minutes exactly on YouTube, and it starts at the bell, no entrances.
Okay.
So it just, I imagine it's got to be fun. Like I said, it's a fan cam from up in the bleachers. I want to say it might have been at Madison Square Garden. And it's from 94 when they were at their peak of feuding, you know. So that's something I'd really enjoy watching later.
Well, you were talking about his theme entrance, and I know they changed it. I believe if I'm right, they changed it. I think right around maybe 94 or 95, 96, whenever he like won the Slammies and stuff. I think I could be wrong. But
I want to say it was actually not until the New Heart Foundation.
Okay.
I could be wrong too. We can always look it up.
I remember playing the Sega Genesis Raw game, and Gary and I would always play it. Mainly just to do the Royal Rumble. And I remember you could go, like, when you're picking your wrestler, you could scroll across. And then, like, wait, like, 2 seconds or 3 seconds, and then the music would kick in for that particular wrestler. And I always thought Owens was the coolest freaking music in the world. I mean, Brett's was awesome, and, you know, you got Shawn's and Razor's and stuff, but Owens, just that beat and the little bit of the guitar and stuff like that, I always loved that thing.
Owen was one of those few guys where he actually had that theme song. The first time that I ever heard it was when him and Coco were teaming. They actually came out to that theme song.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so Owen had that theme song that you're talking about from, like, 92?
Mm-hmm.
All the way up till he changed it to that, and it's time for a change. That he had it for that long. He's one of those few guys where usually, you know, when you turned, you know, heel, in WWF, they would change your music, but they didn't do it for Owens.
No.
And listening to it now, I mean, yeah, it definitely sounds like a babyface type theme song, but it just worked for him. And yeah, I'm the biggest fucking mark in the world. I've actually come out to that at a random indie show before. I just fucking love Owen Hart. I don't give a shit. I've come at his theme song before. And because, I mean, let's just, I hate to say this, but for the most part, and I live in Virginia, wrestle in North Carolina a lot. The type of shows I go to is a lot of kids that they know who John Cena and Roman Reigns are, that they're not going to fucking remember Owen Hart's theme song.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I ate it up the one time I got to do it. I have certain theme songs, like I love Akeem's theme song, I love Dusty Rhodes, you know, but something about Owen Hart's song has just always been my shit, man. And especially, and you talk about it, that's what made me fall in love with it, was that Raw game. I had it for Sega Genesis.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, that was the shit, man, because that one, and because that was one of the big things about the video games, was those starting at... I think it was Super WrestleMania was the name of it.
Right.
Oh, that would have been the first WWF game that came out on the Sega Genesis.
Right.
They would, you know, all those games. Then you had Royal Rumble. Then you had Raw. Mm-hmm. Then you had WrestleMania, the arcade game. But those are like the main four that I personally remember. Every time you would hover over a guy, their music would play. And that was so cool. And this is another touchback to episode one. One time I was playing like the championship mode, I don't know what it was called, on Super WrestleMania, and I was Ultimate Warrior trying to win, and I got to motherfucking Papa Shango, and he beat my ass. Papa Shango's won, so at the end, it plays his music. I was scared shitless of Papa Shango. So I ran and got my mom, and she cut the fucking Sega off so that I could keep playing, because I couldn't stand it. Like, and we're, I'm going off on a tangent, because I got to tell this part of the story, too. So, okay, so I told the story before of how, like, I remember running away, seeing Papa Shango and Kamala. Papa Shango scared me so fucking bad, man. Like, anytime he came on TV, I remember when he put the fucking spell on Mean Gene and he had the ooze coming out. It scared the shit out of me, man. I was so scared of Papa Shango that when, for Christmas, I got his fucking Hasbro action figure. I wouldn't even open the goddamn package. I made my mom open the package. I could deal with looking at the toy of him, but I could not deal with looking at his picture. And now, maybe no, I mean, no offense to Papa Shango the Godfather. He wasn't the, I'm not going to say he was a bad wrestler, but just as far as the type of wrestling I enjoy, he wasn't one of those. But now as an adult, I fucking love Papa Shango. Like, when they had him as DLC for the WWE game this year, I was so excited, man. Like, why? But just, that's just me. I'm going to love a gimmick that was around, what, maybe 2 years?
Yep,
that's the story of my life.
Yeah. I personally, whether it's Papa Shango, comma, Mustafa, or the Godfather, I always preferred Papa Shango. I know everybody likes the Godfather, and I mean, it was fine for what it was, but I don't know, when I go back and watch some of the Attitude Era stuff, I don't have the same fondness for it as I did when I watched it, but
going man, back, yeah, same here.
And that could be a whole entire show, which but we would that, probably get hate for.
Yes, because the Attitude Era is so loved that I remember loving it as a child, and I have gone back and randomly watched it. And I'm like, what the fuck is this? Like, the little bit of wrestling that was on, because you look at it, on a 2-hour episode of Raw, there might have been 30 minutes of wrestling. Mm-hmm. And the wrestling that was mainly put on there, I'm like, what the fuck am I watching?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, but people can hate on the 80s as much as they want to. Mm-hmm. Me, personally, I would much rather watch a show, any show from the 80s. Give me WCW, or I mean, what time, Crockett. Give me that. Give me fucking WWF. I would watch that over Attitude Era. At least at least Raws and SmackDowns, stuff like that. Pay-per-views were a little bit better. I'm not going to say a whole lot, but I that's just me. That's just the type of wrestling I enjoy. It was all story than it was wrestling.
I'd rather sit there and watch. It's the same thing to me. Raw during the Attitude Era was a lot like Mid-South and Crockett. Or not Mid-South, but Mid-Atlantic and Crockett back in the 80s where you'd have, it was an hour show, you'd watch maybe 2 or 3 squash matches and rest were all promos, but still I'd much rather watch Arn Anderson, you know, put a guy in a headlock and watch the ladies come out and dance around and stuff like that.
Watch Coco Beware beat the fuck out of somebody.
Exactly. And most of the time it was, you know, Coco just potatoing the guy and definitely throwing some stiff shots in there. But you were talking about that Super WrestleMania game. Gonna go off on another tangent. You talk about the Ultimate Warrior. That was probably the worst looking character I've ever seen in my life when it came to.
Oh shit!
It looked like he was bleeding from the face. I'm like, really? Yeah. You couldn't have like just put like a white face paint on him or something? But he's red. Yeah. It's like, ugh. He's never wore.
Well, red. Yeah. What can you do? That's the wonderful thing about those old games is you look at some of them and you're like, what the fuck is this? And it's whatever. Yeah. I can't. Yeah.
I'm sure down the road we'll talk more about the greatness that is Owen Hart and our lack of fondness for the Attitude Era.
I can't wait for Gary to come back and be like, what the fuck is wrong with y'all?
Exactly. Because I'm sure we'll probably do a different style or different topic or whatever next week on the 14th of May. But I figured I'd probably do it now because it'll give us more stuff to talk about. this coming May will mark the, I want to say, the 22nd anniversary of the first In Your House. I didn't start getting In Your Houses until later on, because of when I basically got into it. But I did like it that they were a cheaper alternative than paying $30 to $40 or whatever the big four pay-per-views were.
Yeah, because I believe that, you know, it was $30 for the big four. They were closer to 3 hours, if I'm not mistaken. And the idea for In Your House was it was only 2 hours, but it was $15. It was half the price, you know, for a little while. I know, I can't remember when it was, but they ended up raising the price to about $20, which still was a cheaper alternative.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, we could go probably back and pick out, like, tons of, I mean, there, given that, I mean, yeah, there are some of the matches aren't that great, and some of the angles going into it aren't that great. But, I mean, there were some really good matches that came out of this. Now, the first one, the first one was Bret Hart with Hakushi. Then there was Razor Ramon defeating Jarrett and Roddy in a handicap. Then they had a qualifying King of the Ring match with Mabel defeating Adam Bomb. Then there was Yokozuna Owen Hart with the tag belts defeating the Smoking Guns. And then Bret wrestled twice that night, and he lost to Jerry Lawler. And then there was Diesel as the champion defeating Psycho Sid by disqualification. But there were several dark matches that the fans got to see, such as Undertaker defeating Kama, Bam Bam defeating Tatanka, the British Bulldog defeating, actually no, ended in a draw versus Owen Hart for a King of the Ring qualifying match.
And again, these motherfuckers routing me of an Owen Hart match.
Exactly. Or you could have watched the Jean-Pierre Lafitte defeating Bob Holly in another dark match.
Which he's underrated as shit, man. Jean-Pierre is I thought was great. But, I mean, then again, you see certain matches, they weren't as good as others. But I think, I don't know if it was a situation if he was more comfortable with some guys. But, like, I remember him and Bret had, I don't think it lasted long. It was like, I remember them feuding, but I don't remember it really being a long feud by any means.
Was that the one?
They had great gimmicks.
Was that the one with him doing something to Bret's jacket?
Maybe it's been so long.
Because he was the pirate gimmick, wasn't he?
Yes, yeah, he had the, and you know, also he was but yeah, that was after he was in the Quebecers, you know, with Jacques Rougeau,
right.
Which is wild to me that there's, and I could be wrong. Like I said, anyone listening to this, please call me on my bullshit. So, you know, Jock was the Mountie.
Right.
So then they bring in Jean-Pierre Lafitte, mm-hmm. and they are now the Quebecers. Mm-hmm. But so then he goes from being the Mountie to being a tag team, which are still wearing the Mountie gear. But then he's Jacques Rougeau again. Mm-hmm. I don't ever remember there being an explanation of why he's like, hey, look, it's me, Jacques Rougeau. I'm not the Mountie anymore, but I'm still dressing like the Mountie. Because I've heard that, like, Canada was kind of pissed, was like, look, you're portraying our Mounties to be, you know, bumbling idiots and yada, yada, yada. Please fucking stop this. But there was no explanation. It was just, I remember him kind of being off TV for a minute, and all of a sudden, hey, look, it's the Mountie. Because when I was a kid, I remember, because my grandpa corrected me. I called them the Mounties. Because it was just fucking the Mountie and another guy that looked like him. Mm-hmm. And he's like, no, that's the Quebecers. That's fucking Jacques Rougeau. I'm like, bullshit, that's the Mountie. I mean, yes, no, not a five-year-old Court wasn't telling my grandpa bullshit, but you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
Which, that could have been a good story. I should have just went with it. But anyway, tangent again. I remember specifically at least the two Bret matches and the handicap match. I have this tape on VHS at home. because I remember, like, for the life of me, like, I can't remember why Bret had to wrestle twice. I know, you know, I know, I think, wasn't this the Kiss My Foot match with Waller?
I know the Bret and Hakushi match, I'm looking it up now. I know that that match, it said, was announced before, and the Bret had said he was dedicating his performance to his mother because it was Mother's Day, and then the Lawler match, it was, basically, it was Lawler, you know, going in for a promo or something, because they had kind of been feuding a little bit, and I think Bret had gotten hurt during that Hakushi match. I have to go back and watch it, because I haven't seen that First In Your House in a long time. But then, when Bret came out, because Lawler was basically making fun of him, he came out and they, you know, had a match or whatever. So, that's how I remember it. I could be wrong. Yeah, people are going to have to let us know, because it's been so long since I've seen any of those. I do remember that I believe the angle with Lawler and Bret, I want to say that Lawler had responded to, I remember. Lawler persuaded Hakushi that Bret was a racist.
That's right, because the vote for, was it like Superstar of the Year or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was saying, like, Bret made it a point to exclude the Japanese votes. He talked WWF Magazine or something like that. Yeah, right. That rings a bell. Okay.
So, yeah, that's how everything got set up.
So, gotcha. Fucking, man, mid-90s wrestling. You know what? Japanese wrestlers, Japanese fans didn't vote. He's a racist. Okay, fuck it, I buy that, Lawler. Let me beat his ass. Like, what the fuck? So I think, was it In Your House too? I have to look it up. I want to bring this up too. And I know that we're talking about the anniversary of the first one. But there was a lumberjack match. I want to say that was Diesel and King Mabel?
Psycho Sid.
Was that the lumberjack match?
Yeah, Diesel and Sid.
Oh shit!
Was a lumberjack, and that was at the second In Your House.
Okay. So I know Diesel wrestled Mabel later, but I'm just putting two things together. Either way, what I remember about that lumberjack match, I don't remember shit else about it. But fucking Kevin Nash and his big ass does a fucking dive onto these guys like a plancha over the top rope. It blew my mind. I'm like, you big son of a bitch. Like, and little shit, and for anybody, I think we need to have an episode dedicated to wrestling video games, because we've talked a lot about them in this episode. I know I've talked you and Gary into purchasing some versions of it. I'm a huge Fire Pro Wrestling fan. I love the Fire Pro Wrestling series. Specifically, I'm a big fan of Fire Pro Wrestling Returns for the PS2. But anyway, so there's all kinds of moves and stuff, and Kevin Nash is in the game. I mean, you had to change his name because legally they couldn't do it. But so Nash has his typical moveset, right? They made it a point to give this motherfucker a fucking plancha from that one goddamn time that he did it. And I remember playing the game, because, like, if you go over to the ropes and you hit the button to do the move, if it's like a big guy or somebody doesn't have it, they'll just kind of lean over the ropes and kind of throw their arm out, like, come back in the ring. And I'm thinking that's what Nash is going to do. Nope, his big ass just jumps over the top rope and, like, crossbodies like Sting or whoever the fuck I was wrestling. I'm like, that's fucking awesome.
Yeah, I almost want to say, like, I recall Undertaker doing it too. And him being really the first big guy that I had seen do that and being like, wow, you know. Undertaker's, I think at the time he was 6'10 or whatever, and being surprised that he was could jump off the ropes, like over the ropes like that, and land on guys. I mean, Kevin Nash gets a lot of shit for his ring work and stuff, especially in 95 and 96 in the WWF. But I mean, for a big man, I mean, I thought he was really good. I think I know this is going to be basically another tangent, but his match with Undertaker at WrestleMania 12 is probably one of my favorite matches of his that he's done.
Oh, God, yes.
So, I just think that him getting snake bit with that title and given the year and everything like that didn't do him any favors, but...
Oh, no. By no means. While I'm thinking about going back to something you said, talking about Undertaker, you personally, because I can't remember until he's changed his gimmick and more towards the Attitude Era, do you remember the first time seeing Taker do a crazy dive or something like that? Because me, the first one that I can actually remember was when he jumped off, WrestleMania, I think it was 14, when he wrestled Kane, and he jumped off the top rope and I think he leg dropped Kane through a table. I don't remember much before that, as far as the big dives and stuff. There may be something I'm forgetting, but that's the first time I really remember seeing him do something huge like that, showing off his crazy fucking agility.
I want to say that might have around that time frame might have been when I had seen something like that. Yeah, I mean, a part of me. I want to say that it was he had already transitioned out of the wearing the gloves and the spats on his boots and stuff like that, and he went to that other style suit he had on. So it might have been around that time. I just know that from what I can remember that I never saw that many big men do that or whatever. So the Undertaker one stood out to me the most, but I mean he might have done it sooner. I can't remember right now without having to go back and look.
Right, and that's me too. But then again, though, at that time, that's right about the time the Attitude Era was coming around, so he didn't have to completely be that mechanical dead man anymore. So maybe that's when he started doing it. I recently, and by recently I mean fucking yesterday, just saw a clip. Where he had the fucking the rope walk, they call it old school now. I don't know why I fucking hate that name, so I hate calling it that. But the type rope fucking punch or whatever. So he's wrestling Farouk, and this is when Farouk's in a Nation Domination. This is early Nation, so he still had PG-13, Savio Vega, Crush, and they were all outside of the ring. So Taker's going across the ropes, and he stops. And he looks at Farouk, and he looks back at the whole Nation of Domination, and this big motherfucker just jumps out of the ring and cross bodies everybody on the outside. I'm like, why did he never do that again? I'd never seen that. That was a fucking awesome spot. I just love shit like that, seeing guys that shouldn't do stuff. People like Vader, man, one of the most athletic big men of all time, just doing a beautiful fucking moonsault. It's like, man, I'm like a buck 85, a buck 90 right now, and I can't do a fucking moonsault, save my life. And big 400-pound Vader is like, fuck that, middle rope moonsault, motherfucker. I don't get it, man. Some people are just athletic as fuck. I don't get whatever.
Well, I mean, and this will probably tease what the next show is going to be, but going back and watching Halloween Havoc 95 and watching that Sabu match that he had, and just seeing some of the things that he was doing, and the match is short, it's only 3 minutes, but I was surprised going back and remembering how athletic he is and thinking, some of the stuff that I've seen him do, fuck, I don't remember seeing anybody really doing that in matches nowadays, really. And this was not that big of a pay-per-view, and his match, I mean, it was sort of kind of a big deal, but I don't think he really became a mega big deal to everybody else that wasn't a Meltzer subscriber or things like that. But it blew my mind some of the things that he was doing, and we're calling him back.
Oh, dude, shit, Sabu could be a whole episode for me. He's I love Sabu. As much as people shit on him for different reasons, Sabu changed the business. If for nothing else, bringing tables to America as far as on a regular basis. People can say, oh, well, Terry Funk did it before him, and Randy Savage did it before him. Yeah, sure, people fucking did it. But Sabu made it a regular thing. Then Public Enemy stole it from him. Then the fucking Dudleys made it their thing. But either way, talking about that, man, just Sabu was nuts, man. Sabu did all kinds of crazy shit. I agree with you. Like, Sabu was getting kind of a name about him, but until, like, maybe, like, late 96, 97 is really when Sabu was, like, a superstar.
Right.
He was fucking awesome.
Yeah, when he came back for that second run in ECW, and then that's pretty much when I discovered him and taken off. Really, to me, he was a big deal. And it wasn't until like later on I've gone back and watched. I think it was the one match that he had in Los Angeles. I want to say 94, I think, and I think it was with Jerry Lynn. I think that's who it was. That was a lot of people consider one of his best matches. But yeah, so that was a little bit of a tangent there.
Well, to bring it back, a match that didn't happen that, as a kid, I always thought would be cool as shit was Owen Hart and Sabu. Because, going back to me being the action figure kind of sort of that I am, I remember having plenty of Owen Hart versus Sabu matches with, like, when I remember I was so fucking excited when ECW came out with action figures. And Sabu was one of the very first ones that I grabbed. And it was him versus my King of Hearts, Owen Hart. And I was like, man, just could you imagine the cool shit they could have done? Because Sabu is a lot like Owen Hart in the sense of they were doing shit that was way before their time. And I don't think either one of them get enough credit for it. Especially, hell, I'll say even Sabu doesn't get half the credit he deserves for really changing how high-flying wrestling was.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people, rightfully so. They associate him with a lot of the hardcore stuff because,
yeah,
you know, him being in ECW, him, you know, associating himself with the Sheik. But I mean, you take away some of that hardcore stuff from him, and I mean, you can sit there and be mesmerized by a Sabu match from a technical level, and that's what I like, and I think that, you know, a lot of people should probably go back and revisit that really haven't is some of the stuff that he's done that really isn't the classic ECW hardcore stuff.
Well, he had great matches with like guys like, well, even though Benoit broke his fucking neck, but when guys like that were in ECW, he proved that he could out. I mean, Sabu was a great fucking wrestler on top of the hardcore shit. He was just so batshit crazy. He knew that he was going to make more money. Fucking, it's one of those things. I heard Dean Ambrose say it in an interview one time, you use your body as a bargaining chip. And I can tell you that from personal experiences. When guys want you to, hey, can you do thumbtacks tonight? Hey, can you do this? Can you do that? You're like, yeah. Give me some X amount of dollars more, I'll fucking do it. So that's what Sabu's mindset was. He was going to bring this crazy shit, and they used all that shit in ECW to get him over it, because America wasn't used to stuff like that then. So people think of Sabu as the guy that tore his fucking bicep open against Terry Funk in a barbed wire match. People think of Sabu as the guy that's fucking, you know, taping his shit up whenever he get cut open or super gluing something shut. And he gets a bad rep for it because, I mean, I remember being very upset because he, you know, Kurt Angle got put in ECW when they had the ECW relaunch, which, again, could be a completely whole fucking episode or two. I could rant and rave about that shit all fucking day. But I remember the original plan, and I don't think it did happen, was it was supposed to be RVD versus Sabu versus Kurt Angle in a triple threat number one contenders match for the ECW title. And that's when Kurt Angle left, so it just turned into an RVD versus Sabu match, which was still a pretty good match. But I was so excited to see Sabu and Angle, because I knew they could do something special. Yeah, they're going to have the gimmicks, but they didn't have to, because Sabu could hold his fucking own if he wanted to.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I would have liked to. I know when they, when ECW closed up shop, I would have liked to have seen them bring, because I know they brought, you know, obviously brought some of the ECW guys. I would have liked to have seen them bring Sabu in, and have a run during then. But one of the things that I remember about Sabu that I really loved was when he did that small invasion angle, and he did an aerial jump off of the R of the Raw entryway,
and he fucking fell off of it. But yeah. Anyway.
Right, but that just stood out to me, because, you know, I'd never seen, you know, we watched Raw back then, you never saw anybody jump off things like that, and here's this crazy bastard doing that, and he still messed it up, but still was like, wow.
Oh yeah, man, that was, I don't remember as a kid. Okay, so I remember the lead up with ECW Invasion, mm-hmm. and that little thing that happened. For some reason, I don't know if it's blocked out of my mind, or if I decided to watch Nitro that night, or, I mean, I was a fucking kid, I could have went to bed. I don't remember that fucking episode of Raw. I've gone back and watched it. I don't remember shit about it. And then, like, I don't know if it was the next week, or it was sometime soon after that, Sabu came back to Raw again, then had a singles match with Flash Funk. Mm-hmm. That was pretty fun.
Yeah.
You know, Sabu claims in shoot interviews that Vince McMahon offered him a contract, but he wanted to change his name and do things with him, and Sabu's like, no, I don't want to do it.
Right.
And it's like, you know, I don't know if it's completely true or not, because I feel like, at least during that time, I think that they would have known Sabu was a big enough star on his own that you don't want to change anything about him. And that's another thing. Imagine if Sabu had have jumped ship to the WWF. And the matches he could have had with random guys during that time, you know, it could have been great.
Absolutely.
But I talk about, this is just a fucking episode of the Wrestlers of Court Loves, because I fucking love Sabu. I fucking love Sabu.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of those things that, when I go back and I watch. I mean, this really should be the mid to late 90s episode, given what we've talked about tonight. When I go back and I watch WWE during that period, and I see wrestlers that I've since discovered elsewhere, whether it's guys like Tracy Smothers or Chris Candido, or guys like Shane Douglas, I get what the WWE is trying to do, and it just blows my mind that you bring in some of these guys that have name value that the fans should know, and you want to just, you know, just change everything around and stuff. It drives me crazy to think, like, no, you could have probably made a lot more money, or done a lot, or had a lot more fanfare if you'd have just did it this way. And yeah, I'm sure you could have bought their name outright or something like that, to, rather than having to change it. But it's just, I guess we could probably go on for another hour for that too.
No, I get plenty that I can say about that, but maybe we should save it.
Yeah.
Oh, real fast, while I'm thinking about it, it's going back, this whole fucking, I'm going back to all the shit we talked about in episode one. So, the Grimm twins, listen, let me bring this back up for a second.
Okay.
I completely forgot that was the fucking Harris brothers.
Yeah.
Dude, like, I remember them as Jacob and Eli Blue. I don't fucking remember them as the Grimm twins. Like, I remember the name. I created that they were just some jobbers. But that was the fucking Blue Brothers.
Yeah, I didn't know that. And when we were talking about 94 WWF tag team that were around then, I forgot about the Blue Brothers. I think the only time that I really went back and watched something with them in it was probably WrestleMania 11. I don't really recall them all that much, and the Harris twins, I really don't recall watching a lot of their stuff because I really didn't watch TNA and stuff. And a lot of the stuff that I know about them is, you know, what you hear, their reputation that going on and behind the scenes, but that's really about it.
I don't know why, like, it sticks out in my head. I remember Jacob and Eli Blue from, you know, WWF a little bit. Then, of course, wait, later on, they shaved their fucking heads. They were Disciples Apocalypse with Crush and what was his name? I know it's Brian Adams, but... No, wait, no. Right? No, yeah. Brian Lee. No, sorry. Brian Adams had a good superkick. Wrong guy. Primetime Brian Lee. I don't remember fucking Brian Lee's name when he was in... It was... I remember it was Skull, 8-Ball, Crush... The Skull and 8-Ball with the Harris Brothers.
Wasn't there Chains?
Chains! That was Brian Lee. Okay, there we go. Got it. Who, going back to an Undertaker comment, Brian Lee was the fake Undertaker.
Right.
Which apparently, now I've never seen any proof of this. I remember reading online that, okay, so if you recall, Chains left WWF sometime in the 90s. Did not show back up until TNA, when it was doing their weekly pay-per-views, years later, like 2002 or something like that. Well, apparently, Undertaker turned into the American Badass around 1999-2000.
Mm-hmm.
On the indies, I've heard that Brian Lee was doing the fake Undertaker gimmick around that time. If this is true, this could have been another one of those urban legends like Ultimate Warrior Dying. I would fucking love to see an indie with fake Undertaker Brian Lee on it. Please, God, if anyone hears this, has any proof of this happening, send this shit to me, because it would make me happy as hell.
I would love to see him come out to Limp Bizkit.
Oh, shit.
In a gymnasium.
Oh, God. Without naming names and getting any unnecessary heat on me, not as much anymore as it was like 10 years ago or longer, there used to be a lot of fake Undertakers around the North Carolina indie scene. I'm sure it's fucking happened, at least here at some point. Maybe not with Brian Lee, but with someone wishing they were as good as Brian Lee, much less The Undertaker.
Well, given the amount of fake doinks there are, I mean, I'm not surprised that you know, they would do Undertakers and
I know a fake doink.
Do you?
True story. I know one guy who was he'd done fake doink for like 15 fucking years. And to his credit, he's only done it once since Matt Bourne passed away, because Matt Bourne was his favorite doink, which I think really is everybody's for the most part. He only did it once afterwards for a special reason. But he's the best fake doink I've ever seen that wasn't someone actually did doink. Funny story, so in, I want to say this was 97. I think that sounds right. When Austin and Dude Love were the tag team champions at WWF.
Right.
This is back when WWF let their guys do indie shows.
Right.
So I went to a indie show in 97. It was an outdoor event in Danville, Virginia, which is only about 30 minutes from where I live. And the main event on the show was Mankind versus the Honky Tonk Man. On the, yeah, do what?
I said, oh, shit.
Yeah, right. That's the main event, right? On this show also, you had Bam Bam Bigelow, who at the time was in ECW. So think about this for a second. This one indie event, the main event is one half of the tag team champions. He's wrestling his Mankind instead of Dude Love. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he had the tag belt with him. You know, little fucking, like, 8-year-old me has a picture with Mankind, and I'm holding the tag team title. And I remember almost collapsing, because when he put that belt on me, it was heavy as fuck. But, you know, Rock and Roll Express were on that show, which is really cool now, seeing that I've been able to team with Ricky Morton before. Right, Jimmy Valiant was on the show. Bam Bam was on the show. He was in ECW. Mankind was in WWF. Pistol Pez Watley was on the show. Greg Valentine. Disco Inferno, who was in WCW at the time. So, one event on the indies in 1997 had at least one representative from ECW, WWF, and WCW. Well, I tell you all that to get to, Doink the Clown was on the show. Now, I took a lot of pictures, well, someone that I went with took a lot of pictures of the show. I have copies of the pictures. And I was going through them recently, and I recognized the referee. It's a guy named Patrick that is still refereeing in Virginia, North Carolina, West Virginia area. So I was on a show with Patrick, and I brought these pictures to him, and I'm talking to Patrick about it. I'm like, man, one, I didn't know you were in the business that long. Two, man, can you please tell me who the fuck played Doink that night? I thought it was, and I won't say his name, but I thought it was the guy that I knew personally that played Doink. He goes, oh, no, he wasn't even wrestling back then. I'm like, who the fuck was Doink? He's like, oh, it was Steve Kern. Oh. And that blew my fucking mind, because, see, Kern only played the second Doink for Matt Bourne. He might have done some house shows, but, you know, in WWF, Kern never actually was Doink.
Right.
So, he must have kept the outfit, and in a 97, at least, he's taking indie bookings as fucking Doink the Clown. Now it's cool as hell to realize that, like, later on, like, I guess the one indie event where I saw a Doink the Clown was the fucking clone Doink. That's kind of cool to find out, you know?
Well, not only that, too, but given the amount of names that were on that card, I mean, that even, to me, sounds even better, given that was Steve Kern in the face paint. I mean, I guess Disco Inferno would bring it down just a smidge, but, I mean, other than that, I mean...
Just a smidge.
That's a pretty impressive lineup there.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, and I actually have that... I bought that tape at an indie event, like, 2 or 3 years after that. And that company that was... Yeah, they had another event in my hometown, and they had a stack of VHSs, and I go through them, and I find that fucking show, and I'm like, yes! That's it. Give me that fucking tape. So one of these days, and I believe Gary might have a way to do this, I want someone to convert that tape so I can put it online. Because the matches were just, it's wild to think about. Yeah, it's a star-studded event for that time, of course.
Right.
But for all three of these big companies to let their guys do indie shows, it's absurd to think about now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, now, I mean, even if some of the guys would want to do that stuff, I mean, you'd pretty much have to quit the company in order to be able to do that stuff.
Oh yeah, for sure. Like when they sign new guys, like the Hardys got to do some of their indie appearances. They didn't get to wrestle, but you know, little stuff like that they'll let them do if they already had a commitment. But there's no way that they're gonna let like Sami Zayn take a fucking booking for Ring of Honor. You know, there's no way, that, you know, shit like that. Like, and even up to, like, and I know this was just because they had a working relationship, like in 2000 or 99, whenever it was, when they let Taz go to ECW, win the title from Mike Awesome, showed up on SmackDown with it. There's no fucking way they're going to let anything like that happen now, which is, I understand from a business point of view, but at the same time, it's like, man, let's all work together. Let's have some cool stuff. Like, could you imagine if they let, let me just pick a name out of the hat. Like, somebody like American Alpha. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine if they went to, like, fucking Ring of Honor and, like, wrestled the Briscoes or somebody like that? Like, that would fucking be wild, man.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that even when you see a guy like Bully Ray, I mean, I know he signed with them and stuff, but still, I mean, he was just in the WWE as Bubba Dudley, and he obviously was in TNA as that character, as Bully Ray, so to see him even just come in prior to signing and stuff was just like, wow. You know, you're right, you don't see that much that often.
Did you get to see, speaking of Bully Ray, the spot he did with Dalton Castle?
Yes.
Holy shit, that was the best fucking thing I've seen in a long time. I'm all about fucking comedy, wrestling, having a good time, going out there and doing shit. Mm-hmm. Him pulling out the old Bubba Dudley fucking dance,
yeah.
I lost my shit. I lost it. Because that's my thing now. Like, me and my tag team partner come out to fucking 24 Karat Magic by Bruno Mars,
right.
And I act like a fucking just an asshole and just dance all the way to the ring and do dumb shit. Seeing that, I love when I see people I look up to, people I've watched since I was a child, having fun. Because
mm-hmm.
That's what I do, man. Wrestling's about having fun. And, yeah, I know, again, segue for a fucking tangent.
No,
lost my shit when I saw it.
No, I mean that circles back to a couple of the topics that we discussed. You know, about especially about wrestlers having fun. I mean, yeah, I mean you can see that, and you can tell that his run now in ROH. While he probably did have fun the last go around in WWE, you can tell now that he's really having fun working in ROH. But going back to what you were saying just a few minutes ago about taking bookings elsewhere, as a kid, I never knew seeing the Lawler-Bret Hart feud. I never knew that Bret Hart and then even Vince McMahon and Briscoe and Patterson were going down to USWA and wrestling down there. And so, you know, the last couple of years going on YouTube and listening to people on other podcasts talk about it, blows my mind that you could have went down to USWA and seen Bret Hart wrestle Jerry Lawler and the pre-evil Vince McMahon acting evil going down there in Memphis. That would have blew my mind going to those shows back then.
Oh, dude, yeah, I remember recently, I'll come back probably next episode and correct myself. I want to say it was like Adam Bomb versus Sid, maybe, or something, was like the main event at one of these USWA shows. And I'm like, holy shit, like, I can't, they're both contracted at the time, or at least Sid was about to be or something, I don't know. But it's like, dude, can you imagine, like, at the big, like, later on, think about, like, they had the cross-promotion shows with, like, USWA shows of, like, OVW. Or, like, you could go and see fucking Unabomb versus The Undertaker.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, like, shit, like, Smoky Mountain Wrestling would have guys, too. It's like, dude, think about going to your local fucking indie, and you're like, fuck, who are you going to see? Well, I'm going to see fucking Billy Bob Jack off Russell the Undertaker. Wait, excuse me, what? Like,
yeah.
And they don't do shit like that anymore. The closest they do is NXT, but that's still under the big fucking machine.
Right.
The closest thing they've done to it is like letting some of the guys go down to Evolve recently.
Mm-hmm.
Which, even then though, it's cool. It is more of an indie level thing, but to me it's not even the same. It's like what they used to do. Like, Savage had a whole fucking feud of Lawler at USWA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Randy goddamn Savage was on the indies at the same time he was in WWF.
Right.
That blows my fucking mind, man.
Well, that's what even I went back and was able to find. It's on YouTube right now. I don't think there's any commentary to it. I mean, it's grainy, it's old, but I mean, it's still one hell of a match. I knew that, like, Undertaker had gone down to Smoky Mountain and wrestled guys like Unabomb and stuff, but I never knew that Shawn Michaels had gone down there and wrestled. And he wrestled their one of their big shows. He wrestled one night, and he was the IC champion. And he wrestled Buddy Landell, and it was after Buddy Landell had basically turned babyface, and he had cut the promo, I think, the previous television tapings, you know, basically talking about all the demons that he's had with drugs and alcohol and things. And, you know, the fans are behind him, and he wrestles this awesome match with Shawn Michaels, and it just blew my mind. I was like, I never knew that Shawn Michaels had gone down there, given the reputation of him at the time. And that's one hell of a match, and it's one that I like going back to every once in a while and checking out, because, man, I mean, Buddy Landell, I think, is a very underrated worker and everything, but, man, that match was so good.
I gotta go back and watch that, because you just taught me something. I kind of pride myself on being kind of a wrestling historian. Never fucking knew that. So that's kind of cool. That's really fucking cool.
Yeah, and there's another match too. I know Cornette has said that, you know, he's obviously got it on tape because he still has some of the Smoky Mountain stuff. But I know the WWE hasn't put it out, and I've looked on YouTube and I can't find it. So if anybody out there has a link to it, please let me know. But there was also a match where Randy Savage had come down the Smoky Mountain and wrestled Bruiser Bedlam. And Cornette's talked about the story before, basically, that you know, he was expecting just to have a double DQ or something like that, or a draw. But, you know, Macho was down there and said, hey, this guy's your top heel, I'll put him over. You know, and he let Bruiser beat him. And I would love to see that match. I mean, you can go out there. I think they have some of the promos from Savage saying that he's coming down to Smoky Mountain. But I would really like to see that match.
Stuff like that really upsets me. Like, I kind of get it. But, like, you see, like, back in certain eras of wrestling, like, and they finally stopped really pushing house shows, like, in the mid-90s. But I'll see stuff all the time. I'm talking like Mid-South, NWA, even WWF was very guilty about. They would be promoting their house shows. Because apparently, I mean, I it was before my time, but apparently back in the day, that's where the money really was. The pay-per-views were fun, whatever. But in their head, they were like, fuck TV, fuck this, house shows are money.
Oh, yeah.
So you go back. And I remember seeing, oh shit, now I'm drawing a brain fart while we're fucking recording. In 80, was it 7? There was a feud, which is wild to think about during this time, in WWF. It was Kamala, and I want to say, and I'll go back and check this later, you know, fuck me if I'm wrong. It was Kamala and I believe King Kong Bundy were feuding in fucking 1987 in WWF, both as heels. I was watching it on the network, and I only see it referenced maybe twice, two different episodes of Primetime Wrestling. Hell, it could have been one. But they were pushing that, you know, both the managers were pushing, oh, well, my big guy is better than your big guy, yada, yada. And that was the house show feud. And I was asking, my buddy Terry is, I credit him for, he knows everything about wrestling. If I ever tell him something and he says he doesn't know about it, I feel like someone has given me a fucking $1 million, because he knows everything. So I asked him about it. He goes, oh, yeah, that was a feud on the fucking house show circuit for a couple of months. I'm like, you're shitting me, right? He goes, yeah, that's how that worked then. So, like, okay, give you a perfect fucking example. Roddy Piper and Rick Rude, mm-hmm, and was 89. Remember at SummerSlam 89? Piper costs, he helps distract Rude, and Warrior wins the Intercontinental title back, right?
Right.
When do you ever see anything else about that fucking feud? You don't, no. Really. Because that was set up for the house shows. Their feud was strictly on the house shows. Like, you can find stuff on Coliseum videos here and there or whatever, right. But it's like, that makes me so mad as a fan who's spoiled to shit like Monday Night Raw when you get, basically, we're getting, like, Saturday night's main event shows once a week, kind of, if you really think about what, considering what they had back then. Right. Television back then was all squash matches. You might have a main event that was, like, the equivalent of, not taking anything away from them, but to the today's equivalent of like a Zack Ryder versus Curt Hawkins main event is all we ever got on TV. Right. So you had the feud of Piper and Rude went on for fucking months, but just on house shows. Flair and Piper, when Flair came in 1991, mm-hmm. had a series of cage matches. That the world, I think that there may be one on video that exists, but the world would never see half of these matches because they were all on the fucking house show circuit. That's where the money was. Like in 85, there was a huge Morocco Hogan feud that I've always read reviews that like they put on gangbuster matches. You never saw it. There was I personally found one on YouTube from Madison Square Garden. And that's just how the 80s, early 90s worked. You know, I remember when Savage, you know, he was supposed to be retired after the match with Ultimate Warrior at WrestleMania 7. Savage worked a series of house shows. I'm drawing a brain fart again. But Savage worked under a fucking mask on the house show. Yes. I went back... Joe, you're good at finding shit while I'm talking. See if you can find that. He worked a series of house shows under it was like Mass Madness or some bullshit like that. And you can find promos on YouTube where they would do like a Primetime Wrestling or Superstar or something like that, where it was very obviously Randy Savage, but it was a pixelated picture of him. You know, you see him doing all his motions, but you can't tell. I'm doing air quotes like you can fucking see me right now. You can't tell it's Savage, but he was supposed to be yada yada Mass Madness or whatever he was, because they needed him to fill in on some house shows, and he did it under a hood because he really thought in 1991, okay, hey, I'm done wrestling, right. And then they pulled him back in. So it's just little shit like that. It's like I really wish I could have saw stuff like that.
Yeah, well, that's even like. I know there's videos of it, but I know that they didn't do too many, it wasn't any pay-per-views that I believe, but I always liked the Greg Valentine, Tito Santana feud. I think it was like 84-85 for the IC belt. I thought that was a fantastic feud, and I mean, I'm sure that they probably did a couple televised ones, but I mean, there was no pay-per-views for that. And then, you know, you fast forward to WrestleMania 1, and you don't get that type of matchup. They go off and do something else. I would have liked to have gone back and seen some of the house show matches with Shawn and Razor, because they did a bunch of ladder matches prior to WrestleMania 10, and I think maybe a little bit after. I know Bret Hart said that he's done some ladder matches on house shows with various guys. I would have liked to have seen those. Going back basically to our first topic. I mean, going back and seeing some of the house shows with Bret and Owen. I mean, you go back and you look at those and then you see you kind of get some of those surprises when you go to a house show nowadays. But not too often. Now it's, you've pretty much, unless The Rock or Triple H comes back, you don't get any of those big type of surprises or dream matches like you would back then. Now you've pretty much seen everything.
Right. See, that's where the business has really changed. I recently, I admit it last episode, I don't go to a lot of events now. I believe it's probably a big subconscious thing to me. Like I worry about shit a little more than I should, but in my head, I'm like, well, I'm trying to make it in the business. why am I going to a show as a fan? I have tons of fucking friends that do it, you know, so, but anyway, I went to a show recently. It was a SmackDown house show, and the show was great, but you can see how different the guys wrestle on a house show as opposed to on television. I don't know if they have, like, more freedom on the house shows, or if it's they're directed to do certain things, but, okay, little stuff. When you're watching Monday Night Raw, you rarely see, like, okay, a babyface tag team. You know, the one guy's taking the heat, and before he makes a hot tag, you know, the partner's trying to get him to make the tag, right? You hardly see the babyface in the corner doing things like trying to look at the fans and get them behind him, trying to clap his hands or stomp the ring. Certain guys still do it. Like, you'll see Goldust do it because he's old school. He's going to do it that way. But you see guys that are more modernly trained, they don't work the crowd. But, so I tell you all that to get to this point. I saw Rhino and Heath Slater wrestle Breezango. And the whole time on the fucking apron, Rhino is beating the fucking turnbuckle, turning around, yelling at the fans to, you know, help him cheer on Slater, clapping his hands, stomping his feet. But you watch him on television, he's not doing that. So I can only assume there's a different direction. When you're on TV, you want to be focused. They're all about facials. They're all about emotion. They're all about this. On house shows, you're all about crowd reaction because it's not televised. And it's so weird for me to see, especially now being in wrestling for, you know, I'm 6.5 years at this point, and noticing little stuff like this. It's so weird to see them do stuff like that, because, like, when you have the crowd behind you, in a way, you don't have to do as much. If you have the crowd reacting the same way off of a fucking hip toss as you do a Canadian Destroyer, why do the Canadian Destroyer? You've got the hip toss. They know on a house show, this is a night off, so I can do that. But then again, I've seen where Dolph Ziggler and John Cena went 30 minutes doing all kinds of crazy shit. I really think it's a kind of, hey, this is what I'm feeling tonight. I feel like I want to do a bunch. We're not on TV. I don't have to do anything. That's where the business has really changed. Where back then, even with pay-per-views, you would think, in as a typical wrestling fan, the big money is the pay-per-view, like WrestleMania, like SummerSlam, something like that. No, the big money was going to the house shows. They would set up feuds at these big pay-per-views leading to house shows, and that boggles my mind as a fan to this day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure they put it on network now, but yeah, I mean, a lot of times the house shows even too were test runs for potential pay-per-view matchups. You look at Hogan and Flair in the early 90s. One of the ones that blows my mind was the Flair Bret Hart title switch. That wasn't a pay-per-view. I mean, essentially that was like a house show that they were taping. But yeah, I mean, it's crazy how much it's changed. I kind of prefer, as most people probably know, I prefer the older times to now, but...
Me too. I think it's while we probably get along.
Oh, by the way, I haven't found a picture of it. I've seen the pixelated stuff, but it was Mr. Madness.
I was close. I was close.
And there was a couple promos with, looks like Taker and Jake the Snake calling out, it looks like Hacksaw Duggan and Mr. Madness.
So, okay, there we go. Yeah, I knew it was something similar to that. I saw at least one of the pixelated promos where he was cutting it. And there's a possibility there's no in anything that exists of it, but, like, that's one thing about the WWE Network that I love. You know, I love going to, like, the vault section, I think that's what it's called, mm-hmm. where they have the random, like, MSG or Boston Garden shows, which I wish, I love the stuff they put out, don't get me wrong. I wish they would give me more of those random house shows that I know they have recorded for, like I said, Boston Garden, MSG, shit like that, you know, the Spectrum in Philly.
Right.
You know, there's so many great shows that are out there. It's like, I know there's bound to be some footage of that. That's really cool. I mean, maybe there isn't. I could be wrong. But there's got to be something somewhere showing that. Like, I'm shocked they wouldn't add that to, like, a Savage DVD or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I bought both Randy Savage DVDs that they came out with. The one without cooperation from his family. And the one just recently, last couple of years. And, I mean, I thought it was a big deal to see Randy Savage versus Shawn Michaels. I think it's from Germany.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, you don't see any of those types of things. And then hopefully down the road they include them in there.
Oh, yeah. And another thing, too, that I don't want to turn this around, but is it just me or that one, they're more like the recent Savage DVD that came out? I thought they started that DVD off really fucked up. Do you remember how they began it?
Was it him getting in the accident because of the heart?
Yep. Attack?
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I remember.
And that was something that the family had direct input into. Mm-hmm. I thought it was in poor taste.
Yeah. There's a couple. I think it's probably why I was so afraid to buy the Owen Hart one. Because, I mean, I know it wasn't going to be in poor taste, but I was just like, I didn't want it to be like a sob fest and stuff. And
honestly, I'll say, like, DVDs, like, I think, like, the Brian Pillman and the Mr. Perfect one kind of are, like, it's really sad watching those. I love both of those DVDs. It's really sad. The Owen one really isn't. I mean, of course, you got to get to that point, and it is kind of fucked up thinking about it in the past. But the Owen one's really talking about, and I learned a lot, man. And I thought I knew a lot about Owen Hart because I've loved him my whole life. Man, dude, you learn so much. You see some cool shit. And I will highly recommend the Scott Hall DVD, too, if you haven't seen that one.
I bought that one.
I fucking figured.
I poured that motherfucker as soon as it came out. And the funny thing is, too, and even though I wasn't a big fan, but I was just like, oh, this is going to be a sweet collection. I pre-ordered the Ultimate Warrior one that he did when he was alive.
Mm-hmm.
And I was highly happy with it. I mean, I was like, oh, this will be pretty cool. So,
yeah, I got both of the one where he was still alive and then when they released after he passed away. The only thing that kind of sucks about the one after the fact is it's almost the same thing. Because, you know, the first one for Warrior was he tells stories about this era, and then it goes to a match. Then he tells stories, and it goes to a match. Well, the second one is all, like, autobiography-type gimmick, you know, they're telling his story, and then there's matches afterwards. There's a lot of the same footage used, but that's just me. I prefer it that way. I would much rather, even though I love like telling a story and leading to a match,
right.
I would rather tell. Give me the whole story. Give me the documentary first, and then let me enjoy the matches.
Yeah, that's why I didn't. I mean, it's fine. The first Macho Man one, because I think it's Matt Stryker is one of the hosts on it. And it's the same thing even with, like, the, I think it's sort of different, though, but I mean, like, the Class of Champions one and even the King of the Ring retrospectives, like, I don't mind those, like, where you tell a story, go in a match, but yeah, I prefer the documentary style first, and then having a bonus DVD or whatever.
One exception to that rule was I love the Mid-South Blu-ray.
Oh, yeah, the Mid-South one. I would say the Mid-South one's probably my favorite, and then the Bret Hart Dungeon Collection, and then it's toss up from there, from, like, the AWA ones, or the Mid-South, or World Class, or any other small ones.
One thing, if you enjoy the WWE-released World Class DVD that came out, you need to find, I can't remember the name of it, maybe... Was the WWE one called Heroes of World Class, or no?
No, it was the triumph and tragedy of World Class, but I know what you're getting at, because I did
yes.
buy the Heroes of World Class.
Yes.
It's on YouTube, and I wish I'd have known that now, because then I wouldn't have to, you know, not that I forked out a ton of money for it, but...
yeah.
But no, they were both really well done, documentaries. So yeah, if you want to see that, for those listeners out there, you can look it up on YouTube. And I think it's about 2.5 hours long, and it's really, really well done. They dwell a little bit on the tragedy, but with the Von Erichs and then even Gino, but not like the WWE did. So.
Right, and that's one thing about, and I'll only go on this for a second, but World Class, if you notice, I mean, of course, they're always centered around the Von Erichs.
Mm-hmm.
9 times out of 10, though, if you really look at the roster, World Class was more so built around the heels than people remember, because you always had good heels. You had guys like the Freebirds. You had Ric Flair coming in a lot doing stuff. They are the ones that made the Von Erich kids and made any other baby faces. So that was one thing about World Class that was different and people don't remember, is that it really, I guess it was centered around there. It's like specifically like Kerry, Kevin, David, but they were so dependent. There you go. That's the word I was looking for. They were so dependent on the heels to make all the baby faces look good. And that was kind of opposite. Usually, especially like you look at WWF, it was Hogan. Who gave a shit who he was wrestling? Hogan is goddamn the superstar.
Right.
Where Mid-South and fucking World Class and even Crockett to a certain extent, mm-hmm. it was like, here's the heels. The babyfaces are chasing the heels.
Oh, yeah.
And that's one thing WWF did way different from everybody else. I don't know if that was ever on purpose, because Vince had a hell of a mind and did things way different in shows, because he's the only one still in existence. You look at classic wrestling. It was always a heel champion and the babyfaces chasing those champions. And they win, but babyfaces never held belts as long as heels did in those southern-style territories. New York was the only place they had Bruno, they had fucking Hogan, they had Pedro, they had babyface champions, they had fucking Bob Backlund.
Yeah.
They were centered around babyfaces holding belts for a long time, and the heels only had short runs. It's just wild thinking about how promotions that were like 5 to 6 hours apart, me thinking about it, like I'm talking about driving to Philly in a couple of months, I'm like, shit, that's a long drive. In reality, it's really not that far apart, that wrestling was so different between somewhere like Virginia and Pennsylvania. It's wild to think about. Wrestling was different because everything was different back then. There was no TV. You didn't hear about anybody watching stuff from like fucking Los Angeles over here, because the TV didn't make it over here to the East Coast. It's just, it's crazy to think of stuff like that now in the modern age of television.
Yeah, it is, and I'm still disappointed that they never did a proper Von Erich versus Midnight Express feud.
Oh, fuck yeah. Well, oh, my God. I never even thought about that one.
Yeah,
oh, my God.
That's the reason why Cornette and them left, because that's where all the money's at, but it is what it is, so.
Quick question for you.
Yes.
Who do you prefer better, Dennis Condrey or Stan Lane?
You know what? I like the team of Dennis and Bobby. I like Stan. I like both of them. I would say I like the matchups with in Mid-South and early Crockett with Dennis and Bobby, especially with the Rock and Roll Express. I think that matchup to me is what I enjoy more. I don't think he missed a beat with when it got Stan. And they still had good matches with the Rock and Roll. So, but yeah, I prefer probably Dennis and Bobby.
Yeah, see, it's hard for me too, because I cannot tell you that I like one more than the other, but so much.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember more from Stan, so I honestly go towards Stan more.
Right.
And that was a tail end of Midnight Express in reality.
It was.
But have you ever heard the story of why, Cornette wanted to actually bring in Tom Pritchard to be Bobby Eaton's partner. That's why he put Tom and Stan together in Smoky Mountain as the original Heavenly Bodies.
Right.
That's really wild to me because, I mean, obviously, like, I was a kid back then. I was probably 1 year old. Wait, when did Stan join? Was it 88? 89?
No, 87.
Stan was in there that early?
Yes.
Well, shit, I wasn't born yet. Okay, that makes sense. So anyway, okay, so, you know, Stan was whatever. Even going back now, being the guy that I am, watching all this old shit. So, for Jim Cornette, who is one of the smartest men in professional wrestling, to say, man, you know, I really wanted it to be fucking Tom Pritchard, but, you know, Stan Lang was good, so we chose him. Okay, cool. I look back, and I'm like, I can't find shit of Tom Pritchard back then. Where the fuck was he at for Cornette to like him so much?
I almost want to say, I could be wrong, some people out there correct me. I almost want to say that I've heard from other people that he was in Continental Wrestling.
Okay, I've always heard good things about Continental, but I've never watched any.
So I think that's where he was. But, yeah, I think that's pretty much what I've heard. So, yeah. Yeah, when I bought the scrapbook, the Midnight Express.
I'm so jealous of you.
It's out of print, so you probably got to spend a pretty penny. Probably not Gary Hart book money, but it's up there. But yeah, it would have been interesting to see that matchup. But as we all know, I mean, it seems like Cornette and Bobby Eaton pretty much were the ones that stirred the drink, but. But yeah,
I can't be here talking about this shit all day, man. Like, I just, of course, you know, we all love wrestling, but it's so many different versions. But at the same time, I am saying we've been talking for a minute.
Yeah, a really long time.
Yeah, I can hear Gary now, like, hey, y'all shut the fuck up. We said an hour and a half at the most.
Right, and he's going to be like, you fuckers went long, and we didn't go that long the first episode.
Right? See, maybe that says something. Maybe we should do this a little more without Gary. I don't know. I can't wait for this fucking comment from him later.
I know. All right. Well, yeah, we should probably wrap this up. This was our second episode. Like I said, we got more planned. And I know we teased Halloween Havoc 95, so that's probably going to be the next episode that we're going to shoot out to you guys. Hopefully soon.
Yeah, like, I'm not sure if it depends on how Gary feels. We may, you know, we say we're going to release them every Thursday. This one, at the very least, will come out on Thursday. But maybe if we can get it in quicker, maybe I'll shoot the Halloween Havoc one a little sooner. Maybe I'll have more in the bank. I don't know. It depends on the reaction we get. If you guys like what you're hearing, I know me and Joe went on a little while tonight, but let us know some feedback. Let us know what you do like. Let us know what you don't like. We're not going to get mad at you. We want to know what everybody wants to hear.
Right. And that's the thing. This is for you guys. We love doing this. So we wanted to give back to a lot of the followers and new followers to the group and everything. So this is for you guys, so just give us the feedback and let us know what you like and what you want to hear. And, hey, even maybe down the road we'll start bringing in some guests coming in and talking.
Yeah, everybody's wanting it. I mean, I can think of off the top of my head about 3 or 4 people that have already mentioned they want to be on stuff. So if anybody at all is interested in being on the Ringside Chat podcast, you know, we've put on our podcast page the type of stuff we want to do. We've got all kinds of shows. We got, you know, we're going to review certain wrestling shows. Can you think of a bad wrestling show that was really shitty that, you know, hey, you should talk about this? We'll review it. if you can think of, we're going to have a debate where it's two of us or maybe the three of us are all debating on who's better, this team or this team or this manager or this manager. We've got a series where we're rebooking WrestleManias and it's a game to it. We've got all the information on our site. You know, go like us on Facebook. It's the Ringside Chat Podcast Network. We also get our group on Facebook called Ringside Chat. Go join that. We love interacting with everybody. Joe, what's the our Twitter account again?
The Twitter account is the pull this up. It's Ringside Chat Pod. You can find us at Ringside Pod on Twitter. It'll let you. We'll drop hints. I try to get on that Twitter every once in a while, so I'll be dropping hints on what we're doing, links to our shows, and potentially what we'll be recording and things like that. So
yes, just please give us ideas. We're more than welcome to have. We'll add anybody to our conversation that they want to come on. Let us know what you'd like to talk about or what you'd like to hear us talk about. We'll gladly tell you how much we love something, and we'll gladly tell you how much we hate all kinds of shit, including XPW.
That's right. And more importantly, make sure you give Court your money. You know.
Yes. I've got T-shirts, pictures, magnets, coffee mugs. I need that cheddar. I got to get on Skype with Sonny. Somebody help me get some money.
That's right, man. He needs to make that cheddar. All right, so for myself and for Court.
And Gary, who's not here.
That's right, and he's probably shitting his brains out right now.
Poor guy.
We'll see you guys later.
Thanks, guys. Have a good night.